collaborative group project, and this is led by Dave Friedman from Johns Hopkins. Dr. Friedman.
Thank you. Well, we've heard a bunch about diabetes, so I have this talk somewhat geared towards people who might not know that much about it, but clearly it's an enormous problem. Dr. Koh's presentation showed the tremendous growth in diabetes in the United States. Globally, it's become a larger and larger problem. And in the U.S. alone, there's just an enormous number of people with diabetes. And what that means is that diabetic eye disease is progressively going to become a bigger and bigger problem. Diabetes duration is associated with the development of diabetic retinopathy. And if we are getting more and more people in their 20s with diabetes, we're going to have an enormous avalanche of diabetic retinopathy as we move ahead. We've seen several presentations that show, and it's nice to see that it's confirmed in multiple clinics already, that most diabetics aren't getting follow-up. And these are people who came in and got their follow-up. So you're looking at people who got examined, knew to come once at least to the eye doctor, and yet didn't get follow-up. And the uninsured are clearly a really hugely problematic population. I think one thing that stood out in Julia's talk was older people were more likely to come in. Well, how often do you see that? You see that when you have Medicare and you have uninsured in the younger population. That's why you see that. In NHANES, we've seen that almost 4% have vision-threatening retinopathy. And we also know in a classic publication from the NEI, by Rick Farris, showing that 95% of blindness from diabetic eye disease can be completely prevented with just timely attention to screening and follow-up. So this is one of those horrible situations where we have an easy treatment that's effective and relatively safe, and we just need to change behavior and alter our systems. This is a systems failure. Just in case there were people in the audience who didn't know what this stuff was, this is actually the classic photo from the early treatment diabetic retinopathy study, and that's neovascularization.
It's on your mouth.
Oh, okay. This is neovascularization of the disc, and that is a proliferative phenomenon. Those fine blood vessels grow in response to lack of oxygen. That lack of oxygen is treated frequently by killing parts of the retina. And that's how we treat it. So here you see another neovascular area. We've got kinds of hemorrhages, more neovascularization. This is called proliferative diabetic retinopathy. These are proliferating blood cells, blood vessels. This is more advanced, and you can see how damaging that could be. You can only imagine that this needs to be a perfectly intact structure, and instead you have this, fibrotic membrane that's developing. This is a tractional area. You have blood in the subhyaloid, which is just in front of the retina. You have neovascularization here. This eye is progressing to blindness, and without treatment, almost certainly would. There are cases where we call it non-proliferative because you don't see the new blood vessels, but you see a lot of changes in the retina. And the standards for treatment are changing, they're evolving, but many would treat this disease at this point. In the past, based on clinical trials, some may or may not have. And there's a whole diabetic retinopathy complications network that's doing a lot of great research on the best approach. This other disease, so that was the proliferative disease. In diabetic retinopathy, you have another disease, and this relates to how we screen for this. And that this area here is the macula. It's the dead center of vision. It's where we see. And when that area is swollen, if you imagine looking through water, that's what you would be doing. You'd be looking through water. And so you would see things as blurry. And you can see right here, right next to the macula in this photo, there are a few microaneurysms. There's some little blood vessels that are not going to hold water the way they should, but we don't see thickening visibly there. Here we're starting to see the thickening, and this is what's called lipid exudate, and you see that lipid in these cases. And here we see massive swelling. It's not stereo, it's a monographic photo, but you can imagine the depth that this retina is coming out at you. So the basic principles of management of diabetic retinopathy are to control the other factors. And the most important factor, the single factor that can prevent a lot of this disease, is to control blood sugar. But again, that's not done perfectly. It's done better in the United States than it used to be, and there's a lot of therapies, but some patients do not maintain their blood sugar. And globally, it's a huge issue because as we see the global growth in retinopathy, in diabetes, there's far less in place to keep their blood sugar under control. control blood pressure and lipids, and any program that's going to try to treat diabetic retinopathy or screen for and treat it needs to discuss these issues as part of an educational approach. But the treatments that we're going to discuss today are ocular treatments, and I told you that we can prevent this damage, and there are lasers now that do that very well, and we've known that since the 70s. There are surgeries for those membranes, and that's really getting late in the stage and unfortunately highly expensive. And it's interesting, there's this new element of the injectable VEGF inhibitors such as Avastin and Lucentis, and recent studies show that they actually help for macular edema, and so we may see much wider use of that, which will raise cost and other concerns. So I just want to show you this typical example. This is a patient who had this blood vessel growing over here that you can see. Their retina looks terrible. And you've done panretinal photocoagulation. This is a fairly dense treatment. We might not do it that way anymore. But look at that. I mean, if I go back and forth, this retina is looking pretty awful. That retina is dead, but now the rest of it looks pretty good. And that's why you can preserve vision. So they lose a little bit of side vision, a little bit of night vision, maybe a little bit of color. So there is an impact, and it's a negative impact. And this person, believe it or not, might have been seeing 20/20. So this person might have walked in and said, I'm fine. What are you doing to me? So that's part of the whole problem, that these people can walk around seeing fine, and you laser them, and they may see a little bit worse. So there's a whole educational component to the treatment of patients, and that's one reason we don't see the follow-up. Here we see somebody with macular edema after two treatments, and nothing's been done for it. Right? This macular edema is still present. The patient's not doing well, and that's where we're seeing that the VEGF inhibitors are going to be quite important and may improve the outcomes of these patients. So one of the key issues when we think about screening is the giant pool of people that you have to screen to identify sight-threatening disease. Right? So you saw all those people, all the whiteheads are going to come into you, you're going to do something, examine them in some way, and you're only going to find four or five or six who could benefit from treatment at that moment. And it has to go on and on. And so the problem is it can't be hugely expensive or difficult. Right? You have to be able to get people in efficiently, effectively, in order for them to adopt this screening practice and in order for your system to work. Because if you're going to go through 100 people and get five and it costs $1,000 to screen, you can forget about it. The truth is, though, that we do need to screen because if you don't get them early, you get that scarring that I showed you earlier. So we have a consortium, and we're each trying different approaches, but we're trying to think of cost-effective, efficient, publicly adoptable, real-world approaches to this problem. I've told you that half the people who could be screened are not, and people aren't repeating their screenings. They don't come back. So what models in the United States would work to screen people on a regular basis? And that was our primary thought. And you know, the world is changing so rapidly. I have a computer in my pocket. I've, in fact, you know, communicated with the universe several times today while you guys were all talking. I'm sure you all have. We all have the universe at our hands. Things, I mean, the iPhone 4S camera is supposed to be as good as almost any pocket camera you can get. So somebody can have a camera in a little chip on your phone that works so well it can take a picture that's as good as the cameras you used to buy. So telemedicine is obviously a solution to this problem because we can get better and better cameras for cheaper and cheaper, and we have the internet, we can connect people up and get the information we need from that individual. Instead of an instant blood pressure cuff around your arm that gives you an answer, you can have an instant picture of your eye that gives you the same answer. And that's the idea that we're thinking about here. Now, where do diabetics encounter the healthcare system? That's the question. Where can we capture them on a regular basis? And I, you know, we think as a group that you could think about laboratory or pharmacy. I mean, they get drug, they get blood tests. So we have two really good opportunities that are being missed in our healthcare system to capture these people. And the question is, can you squeeze this round peg into that square hole? Because pharmacies aren't used to taking pictures. And neither are labs. So, but it, why not? I mean, if we can make it a kiosk, you sit in, boom, you get your picture, and you walk out, and you're done. If we can make it so simple that it can be adopted, that's what we're thinking of, and that's what we're going to test and study in a research paradigm. So the first thing we're going to do is assess whether or not we can get good quality photos. There are cameras that can take very nice pictures through an undilated pupil. You don't need to dilate. We may miss with these cameras 15% of people. We may not be able to photo them. So those you tell, go on. You got to go. You got to go get an exam. But we can maybe get 85% of people photographed. We need to see how much time is required, and we need to identify any IT issues that might be related to obtaining the image and getting it to a grading center. The other thing that you cannot ignore is some people with diabetes just have poor vision. They have poor vision for myriad reasons. One is non-refractive visual impairment, but the other is refractive. You may not have glasses that you need to see better. And this would be a horrible missed opportunity if we didn't screen for vision loss. So we're going to screen for vision loss, and you can. There are these little on-the-counter screening devices that are relatively inexpensive. Somebody looks in, you can mark their vision, and if they have poor vision, we'll be providing a second service to them. We'll be providing them the opportunity to improve their real-world functioning vision. So it's a nice addition to the plan. How do you tell patients what to do? How do you track them? I mean, this actually ends up being far more complicated than I'm going to discuss right now, but you need software that does this efficiently. You need to store these in a medical file. This is in some ways a medical record. You need to have access to the images if you were to need them for medical legal purposes. There's all kinds of standards on the IT end, so you need to work with a company or somebody that has those things satisfied. And then how do you contact your patients? I mean, I can tell you, almost 100% of people, even in poor areas, have text messaging and use it all the time. So that's an easy way to do it. We're going to see if that's adoptable. We're also going to offer them phone calls and letters and communicate with their doctors. But that is another area of research. How do you keep track of these people? Because they're going to need that one-year exam. And instead of, you know, Julia's example, well, nobody came back, we can remind them repeatedly. We could send them an SMS every few weeks to make sure that they're coming in for their photo or getting their photo. And who gets treatment? That's a hugely complicated thing. So the idea is you get the pictures, and they come in through the World Wide Web into this central grading center. We can grade them and give out the results. So you can coalesce a lot of the management activity into one place. The only thing that has to occur on the periphery is data acquisition. Everything else, contacting the patient, managing the patient, can occur from the center. Sorry. Here's the example that we've come up with. We have a final report. The images are on it. We have a company that's willing to do this grading at a relatively low cost, and we will have a full written report that can go to their primary doctor if they so desire. The resources aren't that great. The cameras are relatively expensive right now. We need the vision tester, and then you need to advertise that you're offering this service, and you need to get somebody to take the picture. And we each have different models for doing that. Our long-term strategy is to optimize the performance so that, you know, Redbox, how it showed up in your, suddenly it's everywhere. Well, we could be Redbox. We could be Redbox for eyes. And, in fact, over time, there'll be auto-refractors built into these things and things that look for macular disease and cataract and everything else. And you'll go into your Redbox, you'll get your eye test, and you'll be better off than you ever were. So that, we've already heard about how great Wilmer is, and Wills and Julia now leaving Wilmer and going. Anyway, so that's the bottom line of our approach. There are various approaches that we're actually trying. Some are hospital-based, and I have no problem with that. One of the big difficulties is the very high price of the camera means that you don't want to have to put these down if you're not going to have a high flow. There are companies developing low-cost cameras that could change everything. If it was the cost of a blood pressure cuff, you'd have it in every office. So it becomes different depending on where the cost points are. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, David.